Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to the reading for the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 24th. I'm Mel from Drake University. Here is our first story. The cover of today's paper has a picture of people walking on the street, and it is captioned, Carrie McDonald, owner of First Row Fitness and Council Bluffs Center, leads the inaugural stroll of the Council Bluffs Community Walking Club along the Valley View Trail near St. Patrick's Catholic Church on Thursday, March 23, 2023. The club, sponsored by First Row and the 712 Initiative, is a free weekly program that encourages all walks of life to get out for some fresh air and exercise at a pace of their liking while meeting fellow members of the Council Bluffs community. Council Bluffs Community Walking Club takes first steps by Joe Shearer at the Nonpareil online. The inaugural meeting of the Council Bluffs Walking Club was pushed back due to sleet and snow last week. And while Mother Nature was still a bit uncooperative this time around, the group made it out for a brisk stroll Thursday morning. About a dozen walking enthusiasts gathered at the St. Patrick's Catholic Church lot just before 10:30 a.m., the starting time for all walks in the coming weeks. This week's goal was to march along the Valley View Trail to the nearby CHI Health Clinic and back. Those who completed the entire route got about 3.5 miles in. The beauty of the Council Bluffs Community Walking Club, though, is that no one is expected to make the whole trek or keep up with the fastest pace. The only expectation is that folks come out and get some exercise and some fresh air while meeting their neighbors and community members. Carrie McDonald, owner of First Row Fitness in Council Bluffs, is heading up the club, which is also sponsored by the 712 Initiative. Before Thursday's group started their walk, she wanted to reiterate the expectations. "I just want everybody to go with a pace they're comfortable with. Get to know each other and enjoy it," she said. "That's the big thing." The sky was gray and winds swept across the trails adjoining cornfields as the walkers hoofed it along Valley View Drive with near-freezing temperatures. Some folks murmured about their reluctance to come out in such weather, but McDonald praised them for their efforts and reminded them that the warmer weather is just around the corner. "We're outside, we're in nature, tuning into the birds," she said. "It's really, really important for your overall health, and a community is great for that as well." McDonald said that walking is a great activity that benefits both the mind and the body, and she said that First Row and the 712 Initiative wanted to create a free program that gets people on their feet and amongst their neighbors. The club meets at 10:30 a.m. every Thursday at different locations across Council Bluffs. The walks last anywhere from 30 to 90 minutes and will feature different levels of difficulty. Some walks will be on paved trails, and some will be hikes through natural areas throughout the city. The next Council Bluffs Community Walking Club jaunt will take place along the First Avenue Trail on March 30th. Walkers should meet at Cochran Park, 100 South 21st Street, just before 10:30 a.m. Here's the rest of the schedule of the club's upcoming spring sessions. April 6th. Wabash Trace Nature Trail, meet at the trailhead. April 13th, Fairmount Park Trails, meet at the 9th Avenue and High Street trailhead. April 20th, Western Historic Trail Center, meet at the Welcome Center building. April 27th, Iowa Riverfront Trail, meet near the stairs at Tom Hannafin's River's Edge Park. May 4th, Lake Manawa State Park, meet in Southeastern parking lot. May 11th, Vincent Bluff Nature Preserve, meet at Thallus Street Trailhead. May 18th, Big Lake Park, meet in the Northern parking lot. May 19th, First Avenue Trail, meet at Cochran Park. May 25th, Iowa Riverfront Trail, meet near the stairs at Tom Hannafin's River's Edge Park. One of the dates is on a Friday, and there may be Saturday walks added to the schedule. McDonald said the walks will be promoted on unleashcb.com, and the schedule and updates can be found on the Walk the Bluffs Facebook page. The next story is titled, Reynolds Signs Bills, Legal Changes Likely, by Tom Barton from Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Des Moines. Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds on Wednesday signed into law a ban on gender-affirming care for minors, as well as transgender bathroom restrictions for schools that are almost certain to be challenged in court. Reynolds signed Senate File 538, making Iowa one of a growing number of states to prohibit gender-affirming care for transgender minors. The newly signed law prohibits Iowa doctors from prescribing puberty blockers or hormone therapy to transgender children under the age of 18. It also prohibits any surgeries on minors intended to affirm a gender that does not match up with their sex at birth. Doctors who violate the bill will be subject to discipline from a state licensing board, and individuals could bring lawsuits against doctors who perform gender-affirming care. Minors who are receiving medical treatment now would have 180 days to discontinue that care. The governor also signed Senate File 482 that prohibits transgender youth from using school bathrooms and locker rooms that correspond with their gender identity. The legislation requires public schools to maintain separate bathrooms, locker rooms, showers, dressing areas, and overnight accommodations for biological girls and biological boys. The bill allows a student who desires greater privacy to request special accommodations from their school with written parental consent. Schools would be allowed to offer those students access to a single occupancy restroom or controlled use of a faculty restroom. Republicans describe the proposal as a common sense way to ensure the privacy and safety of Iowa students. Data, though, overwhelmingly shows that incidents of sexual assault in school bathrooms are rare and that transgender individuals are at a higher risk of harassment, discrimination, and assault if they are forced to use a restroom that does not align with their gender identity. Opponents of the bill have repeatedly said that there have been no incidents of transgender students in Iowa harassing their peers or misbehaving in bathrooms over the last 15 years. They have noted that Iowa schools have been able to provide accommodations without issue. Reynolds on Tuesday told reporters banning gender-affirming care for Iowans under the age of 18 is in the best interest of the kids to whom her heart goes out. Reynolds also fired back at the proposed law's critics, who she said remind her of the critics of her move to reopen Iowa schools and businesses earlier than some other states during the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic. Echoing arguments made by some Republican lawmakers during debate, Reynolds on Tuesday said she does not believe the science is settled on the long-term impacts of gender-affirming care. Emboldened by 6 years of conservative reforms under their belts and multiple elections that expanded the majorities in the House and Senate, Iowa Republicans have pushed a more conservative agenda this session, one focused on gender policies and curricula and books in schools with LGBTQ themes and other measures targeting LGBTQ people, mirroring efforts in other GOP-led states. A record 29 unique pieces of anti-LGBTQ legislation were introduced this legislative session, said Keenan Crow, a lobbyist with LGBTQ activist group One Iowa. That, they said, compares to 28 LGBTQ-related bills introduced during the two-year General Assembly from 2021 to 2022. The Iowa legislator and Governor Reynolds have repeatedly targeted the most vulnerable students with rhetoric and legislation designed to suppress, out, target, ban, and censor Iowa's LGBTQ+ student communities. Bike Baranek, president of the Iowa State Education Association, Iowa's main public teachers union, said in a statement, despite these shameful acts, the ISEA continues to stand with and fight for all of our students, ensuring they are safe, healthy, happy, and learning, Bierneck said. Legal challenge is likely. Thousands of Iowans have publicly protested the GOP-backed legislation targeting the LGBTQ plus population, including a group of about a dozen Ankeny businesses. The group of businesses said the hateful and discriminatory legislation will directly impact our businesses' ability to find and retain employees and customers and to thrive in our state. The bills will likely be at least temporarily halted by a legal challenge. Similar bills in other states are being challenged in the courts. Opponents note the legislation conflicts with both state and federal civil rights protections. Gender identity was added as a protected class to the Iowa Civil Rights Act in 2007. The protections extended to education and public accommodation. At the federal level, Title IX protects gender identity when it comes to restrooms and facilities, access, and schools. North Carolina passed the nation's first bathroom bill in 2016, which sparked a nationwide backlash, boycotts, and a lawsuit challenging the law's constitutionality. The state settled that lawsuit in 2019 and is now prohibited from passing laws that prevent transgender people from using bathrooms that align with their gender identity. The Iowa Supreme Court last year ruled in favor of a transgender employee at the Department of Corrections who argued it was gender discrimination to be required to use a unisex restroom instead of facilities that aligned with their gender identity. It is simply wrong for Governor Reynolds to sign a law that will have devastating consequences for many children and their families in our state, Mark Stringer, ACLU of Iowa executive director, said in a statement. It should be parents, doctors, and mental health professionals who make these decisions, not politicians trying to score political points by throwing transgender kids under the bus. Stringer and Democratic lawmakers said they are already hearing from families who say they are making plans to move out of the state or move their transgender teen out of the state. Parental choice. Republican legislators who proposed and advanced the ban on gender-affirming care say it is necessary to protect children from medical care and treatments when the science is not settled. Even though all major medical groups in the U.S. say the treatments are safe and the vast majority of studies show that the care leads to better mental health outcomes. Doctors, LGBTQ, and civil rights advocates say medical care is being politicized and creating a climate of fear. Reynolds and other Republicans have pointed to studies and actions in some European countries. For example, the United Kingdom's only center dedicated to gender identity treatment for children will close, and Sweden last year began restricting hormone therapy for minors. Most medical studies show gender-affirming care is beneficial for young people experiencing gender dysphoria. Some have noted possible long-term effects and suggest more research is needed. Lawmakers also heard testimony in recent weeks from doctors who said providing gender-affirming care to minors is a methodical, deeply personalized process that involves multiple doctors and parental consent. Five House Republicans voting against the bill said it runs counter to the parental choice mantra. Republicans frequently champion preventing parents from getting their child and the medical care they need. By signing these bills, the governor has shown that she doesn't actually care about parental rights, said Becky Taylor, executive director for Iowa Safe Schools, said in a statement. Iowa Safe Schools provides education, outreach, advocacy, and victim services for LGBTQ and allied youth. The parental rights LGBTQ families have been sidelined for the sake of the governor's ill-fated power trip to national office. Taylor said, the governor's legacy will be forever tainted by the day she signed away parental rights and put children's lives directly at risk. Reynolds also signed HF 337, a bill for an act relating to the use of certain refrigerants. HF 202, a bill for an act relating to explosive materials, including blasting agents, detonators, and destructive devices, providing penalties and including effective date provisions, HF 113. A bill for an act relating to the State Public Defender Pilot Project for Child Welfare Legal Representation. SF 154, a bill for an act exempting hydro excavation equipment from certain size, weight, load, and permit requirements on highways. SF 157, a bill for an act authorizing certain persons to administer the final field tests of an improved driver education course. HF 133, a bill for an act relating to refund payments made in connection with motor vehicle debt cancellation coverage. HF 205, a bill for an act relating to the distribution of certain barrel tax revenues collected on beer. HF 257, a bill for an act relating to third-party testers who administer the knowledge and driving skills tests required for commercial learner's permit or commercial driver's license. The next story is titled, Support Teachers, LaFrillo says. Council Bluffs Schools Foundation hosts luncheon by Tim Johnson from the nonpareilonline.com. A good crowd attended the Council Bluffs Schools Foundation's Education is Everyone's Business lunch Wednesday at Mid-American Center. Superintendent Vicky Murillo gave attendees an update on the school district, going over how the district's high school students can earn college credit, certificates, or two-year degrees without paying for them through its Diploma Plus One pathways. This year, through the district's TradeWorks Academy, 521 students will achieve an industry-recognized credential from OSHA-10 and Foundational Skills for TradeWorks at Iowa Western Community College. She said, through TradeWorks at Iowa Western, 97 students will achieve an industry-recognized certificate and/or diploma. Through the Early College Academy, 25 students will graduate from Iowa Western, Murillo said. Each student's family will have saved $12,660 in college tuition on an associate's degree. Since the program began in 2018, 128 students have participated. Currently, 594 students are taking college credits that can be applied toward a 2 or 4 year degree through the district's College Credit Acceleration Program, she said. There is a wide variety of course choices to fit students' interests, including 35 high school delivered concurrent enrollment courses, 14 advanced placement courses, STEM concentrated courses, or any course at Iowa Western. In the class of 2022, 108 students completed their first year of college, 24 credits, through these opportunities. Tuition saved by each of their families was $5,604. Through the career and academic pathway, 190 students are currently enrolled in business management and administration, emergency technologies, medical health sciences, early childhood education, or hospitality management. These students will have earned 3,608 credits over the two-year program in each field of study. This fall, aviation science, STEM concentrator, and biomedical science will be added to the offerings. Aviation science. Students can earn an FAA Part 107 credential by completing engineering coursework and Durham certification training, as well as the aeronautical knowledge test. STEM concentrator. Students earn the STEM Concentrator Certificate by completing engineering and math coursework. Biomedical Science. Students earn the Certificate Nurse Aid or Biomedical Concentrator Certification through Project Lead the Way coursework and concurrent enrollment health courses. Also, beginning this fall, the district's middle schools will offer elective classes that will help students learn what they are interested in and prepare for possibly following one of the pathways when they get to high school. In addition to the pathways, the district offers market value assets, including the Air Force JROTC Leadership and Employability Skills Certificate, a Seal of Biliteracy, the ACT National Career Readiness Certificate, Google Certificate, or Transition Alliance Certificate, Maria said. She thanked the foundation for helping to support the school's staff and students. Chris LaFerla, Executive Director of the Foundation and President of the School Board, shared how school became such an important part of his life as part of his keynote address. He grew up with his parents who used drugs and neglected their children. We moved a lot. We were homeless from time to time, living in a car, LaFerla said. Absent supervision, I did what I wanted, which included wandering around at night. School was the safe place in my life, he said. Teachers were the only adults I could trust. LaFerla's music teacher enrolled him in an honor choir, which performed a Christmas concert on local TV. It was the first time I felt special for something, he said. By the time I was in high school, I practically lived at school. LaFerla participated in music theater, clubs, and sports. His teacher showed him compassion, challenged him, and helped him believe in himself. I went to school early and stayed until late in the evening, he said. Council blessed schools, teachers, and coaches saved my life. Today's teachers are saddled with more duties and expectations than ever. Yet they are not expected as much as they used to be, LaFerla said, and many are leaving their classrooms behind. In 2017, the number of teacher vacancies in the United States was outnumbered the candidates, and the gap has been growing ever since. In February, openings exceeded candidates by 180,000. Teachers are quitting at the highest rate ever recorded, he said. At the same time, more than 60% of parents surveyed said they don't want their children to become teachers, LaFerla said. And they're not. The number of students majoring in education is smaller than the number needed. We have to give teachers more respect before the looming teacher shortages claims Iowa as a victim, he said. Let's return to a time when teachers are respected and it's a respected profession. Right now, we're going the wrong direction. Teachers should be paid more too, LaFerla said. Can we afford not to make that investment, he asked. While an individual can turn the ship around by themselves, they can set a positive example, LaFerla said, and listed the following. Assume positive intent of teachers, share positive stories about public schools, demand support for public schools. Funding makes a difference, but so do words, he said. The foundation honored Barry Cleveland with a Community Impact Award. Cleveland has contributed to many causes in the community. He was part of the leadership team that raised money for the Dream Playground Reimagined project and the team that sparked the renovation of the Gail Wickersham Athletic Complex. He helped develop the Red and Ruth Nelson Excellence in Education Teaching Awards. He served as a board member and chair for the Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce and a board member of the Interim Executive Director of the Council Bluffs Community Education Foundation, and has helped with many community projects and events. A 1971 graduate of Abraham Lincoln High School, he was inducted into the Abraham Lincoln Hall of Fame in 2018. The foundation has also kicked off its annual community impact campaign. This year's drive, with the theme Together We Can, aims to raise $90,000. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 24th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Mel from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. We will now read through today's obituaries. John Jensen, January 30th, 1937 to March 22, 2023. A life lived with purpose and generosity. John Jensen, a beloved father, husband, friend, and photographer, passed away peacefully in Oakland, California at the age of 86. Born on January 30, 1937 in Council Bluffs, Iowa, John spent his life effortlessly putting others first, leaving a legacy of warmth, kindness, and generosity. John's unwavering spirit of service began when he served as a photographer in the Army during the Korean War. Upon returning from military service, he pursued his passion for photography by opening his own photography studio in San Francisco, where he worked for over 20 years. John had an uncanny ability to capture the essence of a person through his lens, and he particularly enjoyed taking portraits of aspiring actors and models, helping to propel their careers forward. His keen eye and gentle demeanor put his subjects at ease, allowing their personalities to shine through in the images he created. Beyond his career as a photographer, John's insatiable curiosity led him to become an author, writing a helpful automotive book on microcars called Isetta Restoration that would assist others in their passion for these unique vehicles. His love for learning and sharing knowledge was contagious, inspiring those around him to pursue their interests and dreams. John strived to make life better for his loved ones. His devotion to his family was unwavering, and he was a constant source of support, encouragement, and love. He was the glue that held his family together, always there to lend a hand or a shoulder to lean on. John Jensen's life was a testament to the power of selflessness, kindness, and love. As we remember and celebrate his life, we are reminded of the countless lives he touched and the impact he had on those around him. His legacy will live on in the hearts and minds of his family, friends, and all those who had the privilege of knowing him. May John Jensen's warm-hearted spirit continue to inspire us all as we seek to live our lives with purpose, love, and a generous heart. Rest in peace, John, and thank you for the gift of your life. John is survived by his son Julian, daughter-in-law Madison, brother Clark, and sister Elaine, and dog Mako. His wife, Rosalind, passed away in 2020. John's ashes are planned to be spread in the San Francisco Bay along with Rosalind in April 2023. Linda Trapp, October 4th, 1941 through March 16th, 2023. Linda Trapp, 81, of Lawton, Oklahoma, passed away Wednesday, March 16th, 2023, with her family, friends, and caregivers by her side. She was born to John and Bernice Johns on October 4th, 1941 in Albion, Illinois. She graduated from Omaha Technical High School in 1960. She married Richard Allen Trapp in 1962 and lived in the Omaha, Nebraska, Council Bluffs, Iowa metro area until relocating to Lawton, Oklahoma in 2012. She is survived by her children, Scott Trapp of Richmond, Virginia, Leah Trapp of Leahy, Utah, and her grandchildren Bernice Trapp of Lincoln, Nebraska. She was predeceased by her devoted husband in 2015. Linda had a career in banking with Omaha National Bank as an operations officer and later with United Parcel Service in their payroll department. Although she had a career in numbers, she was an artist at heart. She was a talented baker, basket weaver, and craft artist. Her beautiful baskets, wooden and painted crafts, were beautiful gifts and adorned the homes of her loved ones. It was always a delight to receive a box of her whimsical cookies on special holidays. A memorial ceremony will be held on Monday, March 27, 2023, at 12 p.m. time in the First Christian Church, 701 Southwest D Avenue, Lawton, Oklahoma. Following the service, Linda and her late husband Richard will be interred in the Fort Sill National Cemetery at 2 p.m.
The family requests donations in support of the Wichita Mountains Wildlife Refuge at friendsofthewichitas.org in lieu of sending flowers. The next story is titled, Book Ban Attempts Hit Record High in 2022. New York. Attempted book bans and restrictions at school and public libraries continue to surge, setting a record in 2022, according to a new report from the American Library Association released Thursday. More than 1,200 challenges were compiled by the association in 2022, nearly double than the LEN record total from 2021 and by far the most since the ALA began keeping data 20 years ago. I've never seen anything like this, said Deborah Caldwell Stone, who directs the ALA's Office for Intellectual Freedom. The last 2 years have been exhausting, frightening, outrage-inducing. Thursday's report not only documents the growing number of challenges, but also their challenging nature. A few years ago, complaints usually arose with parents and other community members and referred to an individual book. Now the requests are often for multiple removals or organized by national groups such as the Conservative Moms for Liberty, which has a mission of unifying, educating, and empowering parents to defend their parental rights at all levels of government. Last year, more than 2,500 different books were objected to, compared to 1,858 in 2021 and just 566 in 2019. In numerous cases, hundreds of books were challenged in a single complaint. The ALA based its findings on media accounts and voluntary reporting from libraries and acknowledges that the numbers might be far higher. Librarians around the country have told of being harassed and threatened with violence or legal action. Every day, professional librarians sit down with parents to thoughtfully determine what media material is best suited for their child's needs. ALA President Lessa Kamenoka Paleo Lozada said in a statement, "Now, many library workers face threats to their employment, their personal safety, and in some cases, threats of prosecution for providing books to youth they and their parents want to read." Caldwell Stone said some books were targeted by liberals because of racist language, notably Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, but the vast majority of complaints come from conservatives directed at works which LGBTQIA+ or racial themes. They include Maya Kobabe's Gender Queer, Jonathan Avizon's Lawn Boy, Angie Thomas's The Hate U Give, and a book-length edition of the 1619 Project. The Pulitzer Prize-winning report from the New York Times on the legacy of slavery in the United States. Bills facilitating the restriction of books were proposed or passed in Arizona, Iowa, Texas, Missouri, and Oklahoma, among other states. In Florida, where Governor Ron DeSantis approved laws to review reading materials and limit classroom discussion of gender identity, the race books pulled indefinitely or temporarily included John Green's Looking for Alaska, Colleen Hoover's Hopeless, Margaret Atwood's dystopian novel The Handmaid's Tale, and Grace Lynn's picture story, Dim Sum for Everyone. More recently, Florida's Martin County School District removed dozens of books from its middle and high schools, including numerous works by novelist Jodi Picoult, Toni Morrison's Pulitzer Prize-winning Beloved, and James Patterson's Maximum Ride. Thrillers, a decision the best-selling novel author criticized on Twitter as arbitrary and borderline absurd. DeSantis called reports of mass bannings a hoax, saying in a statement earlier this month that the allegations reveal some are attempting to use our schools for indoctrination. Some books come back. Officials at the Florida's Duval County Public Schools were widely criticized after they removed Roberto Clement, The Pride of Pittsburgh Pirates, a children's biography of the late Puerto Rican baseball star, In February, they announced the book would again be on the shelves, explaining that they needed to review it and make sure it didn't violate any laws. This story is paired with a picture of a person reading through a stack of challenged books. And it is labeled a pile of challenged books from December 16, 2021 at the Utah Pride Center in Salt Lake City. From the Nation and World section, this article is titled Committee Grills TikTok CEO. Official faces questions over security content of Chinese platform. Washington. U.S. lawmakers grilled the CEO of TikTok over data security and harmful content Thursday, responding skeptically during a tense committee hearing to his assurances that the hugely popular video sharing app prioritizes user safety and should not be banned. Xu C. Cruz's rare public appearance came at a crucial time for the company, which has 150 million American users, but is under increasing pressure from U.S. officials. TikTok and its Chinese parent company, ByteDance, have been swept up in a wider geopolitical battle between Beijing and Washington over trade and technology. In a bipartisan effort to rein in the power of a major social media platform, Republican and Democratic lawmakers pressed Xu on a host of topics, ranging from TikTok's content moderation practices, how the company plans to secure American data from Beijing, and its spying on journalists. Xu, a 40-year-old Singapore native, told the House Committee on Energy and Commerce that TikTok prioritizes the safety of its young users and denied it's a national security risk. He reiterated the company's plan to protect U.S. user data by storing it on servers maintained and owned by the software giant Oracle. Meanwhile, lawmakers questioned Secretary of State Antony Blinken about the threat TikTok poses at a separate but simultaneous committee hearing. Asked by Representative Ken Buck, a Republican from Colorado, if the platform is a security threat to the United States, Blinken said, "I believe it is. Shouldn't a threat to the United States security be banned?" Buck responded, "It should be ended one way or another, but there are different ways of doing that," Blinken responded. Israel sees unrest after new law protects Prime Minister. Israelis protesting against plans by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to overhaul the judicial system scuffle with police Thursday in Tel Aviv, Israel. Netanyahu's governing coalition on Thursday passed the first of several laws in its contentious judicial overhaul. Thousands opposing the changes staged another day of demonstrations to raise alarm over what they see as Israel's descent towards autocracy. Blocking traffic on main highways and scuffling with police, Netanyahu's coalition approved legislation that would protect the Israeli leader from being deemed unfit to rule because of his corruption trial and claims of conflict of interest surrounding his involvement in the legal changes. DA rejects GOP demand for info. Washington. The Manhattan District Attorney investigating Donald Trump rebuffed House Republicans' request Thursday for documents and testimony about the case, dismissing it as an unprecedented inquiry with no legitimate basis. The general counsel for Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg slammed the congressional request as an unlawful incursion in New York sovereignty. The Republican chairman of three House committees sent a letter Monday to Bragg seeking information about testimony documents and copies of communications with the Justice Department. A grand jury in New York is weighing whether to bring an indictment against the former president. The case revolves around hush money payments during Trump's 2016 presidential campaign to women who allegedly sexual encounters with him. Pentagon proposes $842 billion budget. Washington. Pentagon leaders said Thursday the U.S. military must be ready for possible confrontations with China as they push Congress to approve the defense budget's proposed $842 billion budget, pointing to increases in new technology like hypersonics. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the budget proposes to spend more than $9 billion, a 40% increase over last year, to build up military capabilities with the Pacific and defend allies. Meanwhile, Chinese diplomats expressed strong opposition to an expanded United States military presence in the Philippines in closed-door talks with their Filipino counterparts Thursday in Manila, a Filipino official said, underscoring the intense U.S.-China rivalry in the region. We will now read over some of the sports section. Boys golf, a new era begins for Trainer Golf. This is accompanied by a picture of Trainer, and it is labeled Trainer's Ethan Kahn's tees off the ninth hole during the Class 2A Boys Sectional Golf Tournament at the Trainer Recreation Area on Wednesday, May 11th, 2022. From Joe Shearer, the Daily Nonpareil. Fewer teams have as many unknowns as the Trainer Boys Golf sees this season. With a new coach and plenty of new faces teeing off the new season, the Cardinals aren't sure of what to expect in 2023. There are still some familiar faces back on the fairway. The Cardinals have a new coach leading the program. Nonetheless, the team is excited to see what they can accomplish this season, but aren't ready to set too many goals until they have tested their might against some competition first. As I have discussed with our team, goals and expectations aren't easy to set during a coach's first season. First-year Cardinals coach Rob Wilkie said, Coach Thad Nelson, who was the program's head coach for over a decade, has been great about making the transition as smooth as possible, but it will take some time for me to get to know the boys and their skills before we can have a serious discussion about our team goals for the upcoming season. We have a number of returning players who I am excited to work with and will lean heavily on to show me the ropes. While the defending Western Iowa Conference champs have lots of new faces in the program, no one is calling this a rebuilding year. We lost some solid players from last year. Ryan Kahns, Ryan McIntree, Gabe Travis, and Tyler Christensen will be missed for not only their golf ability, but also their leadership, Wilkie said. This isn't a rebuilding year. We have a great team that can do great things. But our varsity squad will have some new faces this year, including mine. Coach Wilkie will still have some solid leadership on this year's team. One of those names is Ethan Kahns, who won the individual WIC title in his sophomore season last year. Coach Wilkie and the Cardinals expect him to have another big season this year. The expectations will be high for Ethan Kahns this year. He is capable of achieving great things, and I look forward to doing everything I can to help him achieve his personal goals. Ethan's prior achievements will make it easy to forget he's just a junior, but his best is yet to come. The Cardinals will play Underwood for their first meet on October 5th at the Trainer Recreation Area at 4 p.m. Soundtrack of March Madness, Clay. Kansas City, Missouri. Folks across the country watching the first round of the NCAA tournament last week thought it rightfully funny when they saw a couple of stadium workers scurry up a ladder and place a construction level across the rim. Turns out, Iowa State players, puzzled by their shots clanking off the iron during the pregame warmups, were right. It wasn't perfectly horizontal. The NCAA acknowledged later that a minor adjustment was made before the game, and the Cyclones were quick to say afterward that it had no bearing on their 59-41 loss to Pittsburgh. But whether the rim was physically off-center or caused Iowa State to be mentally off-base, the result was unmistakable. The Cyclones trailed 22-2 to start the game, finished 23.3% from the floor, and perhaps most jaw-droppingly, were an abysmal 2 out of 21 from three-point range. It just wasn't going in, Cyclone sharpshooter Gabe Kalshner said. Sometimes that happens. From the three-point line, it's happening more than ever. Team shot 31.2% from beyond the arc during the opening weekend, the worst percentage since the NCAA added the line for the 1987 tournament. And of the 16 teams that advanced to the second week, half of them shot worse than 30% last week. Only UConn was over the 40% mark heading into its game Thursday night against Arkansas. I do think this. I think there is a great deal of emphasis placed on how defense in college basketball now, said Tennessee coach Rick Barnes, whose team was 4-16 from the arc in the first round against Louisiana but bounced back against Duke. You come down the court, whether you're playing Louisiana at the other night or Duke. Can we find a way to score here? Can we shake loose and get a good look? If you do get it, oftentimes I think players are surprised that they've got such a good look, Barnes continued. I do think defense probably has as much to do with it as anything. That goes for in the paint and on the perimeter. Teams have become so adept at clogging the interior, preventing easy buckets in the posts and clean drives to the rim, that the ball sticks outside. And when it's there, play has become so physical that just about every look from three is contested. There's a lot of fouling going on the perimeter, in particular, said Huskies coach Dan Hurley. We talk so much about freedom of movement, and I just think there's a little bit of physicality that's going on with the dribble drivers and people trying to utilize screens on the perimeter, and that muddies and mucks up the game. Defense is one valid theory for all those first-round breaks, but there are others. For one thing, the line itself keeps moving back. It began at 19 feet 9 inches from the rim, moved back a foot for the 2008-2009 season, and scooted back again to match the FIBA international standard of 22 feet, 1 3/4 inches for the 2019-2020 season. Also changing the ball. The NCAA tournament is using a new iteration of Wilson's Evo NXT, which the company claims to be the highest caliber of basketball and was designed in concert with the NCAA and several members of schools. Wilson executive Kevin Murphy has said the ball has an extra layer of grip, which ostensibly makes it easier to shoot from long range, but it is nonetheless a departure from the ball that schools have used throughout the regular season and conference tournaments. Division I teams shot at 34% clip from three during the regular season, or nearly 3% better than they have during the Big Dance. And 8 of 68 teams have had their worst three-point shooting games of the season during the NCAA tournament. What makes the shooting slump so head-scratchingly strange, though, is that 36 teams that began the tournament actually shot better than the national average this season. That includes 5 of the top 10 teams from beyond the arc, and 2 of them, Xavier and Michigan State, were still alive for the Sweet 16. Spartans coach Tom Izzo wrote off the poor three-point shooting as a function of the sample size. Over the conference season, we're a team that shot almost 40% from the three, said Izzo, whose team was 5-14 against Southern California and 2-16 against Marquette. It's second worst three-point shooting performance of the season. The sample size, 2 games, I don't think it's in anybody's head. We just didn't shoot as well in those 2 games. Who else didn't shoot it well? Top-seeded Purdue, which was 5-26 from the arc in its stunning loss to number 16 seed Fairleigh Dickinson, and second-seeded Arizona, which was 3-16 when it fell to number 15 seed Princeton. Still, that wasn't enough for the UCLA coach Mick Cronin to be concerned about the poor shooting during the NCAA tournament. So we're talking about 1%, he asked. If we're not talking about my portfolio, I'm not interested. Lynx Bringing Heat in 23 by Austin Heinen. The new season is less than a week away, and Abraham Lincoln's girls' soccer is ready to make another run with another loaded team. The Lynx fell one win shy of the ultimate goal after making a run to the Class 3A championship game, but fell 2-0 in the Ankeny Centennial. This year, with plenty of experience back in the fold, the Lynx goals are just as big as last year as they look to make another run for a chance to finish what they started. We've been climbing the mountain of high expectations and getting in closer and closer to the top each season, Lynx coach Robbie Miller said. Last season, we saw the peak, and we know what it takes to get back. Our goal is to win a state championship and embrace all the work and togetherness it takes to get there. Offensively, the Lynx will have a hole to fill with last year's team and city leading scorer Hannah Schimmer, now at Iowa Western, losing other key seniors like Abby Evers and Paige Bracker, among others, leave some big shoes to be filled. Despite losing these players and others, the Lynx still have plenty of returning firepower and experience. We've got a lot of players coming back who have lots of varsity experience in a variety of roles. How players adjust and accept bigger roles will have a large impact on whether we can meet our goals. We have a very challenging schedule, especially early in the season, which will help us figure out who we are and how we need to get there. Miller went on to list some of the returners who will help lead the team. Jasmine Martinez-Rangel will lead our teams through the midfield and off the field. She has taken ownership of this team, and she's a great leader. Piper McGuire, coming off an injury and hopefully returning in May, has been a strong voice guiding and helping players move into new roles. Liberty Bates will be our star on offense. We expect her to score and assist lots of goals, which she is more than capable of doing. Savannah Vanderwerf will continue her dominance between the pipes and be one of the best goalkeepers in the state. Lexi Mayo, Trista Baker, Lily Bates, Jillian Mathera, Sylvia Stott, Megan Ellum, and Kenzie Bayman will solidify our defense. Haley Santon, Allie Smith, Taylor Ferguson, Aubrey McCumber, and freshman Allie Bombach will play large roles in our offense. After making the state championship game last year, the Lynx know they are going to get everyone's best effort, as the target on their backs is now as big as it's been before. The Lynx will have no shortage of challenging opponents either, with St. Albert, Ankeny, Ankeny Centennial, Bishop Heelan, and Glenwood for their first five games of the season. But this is exactly how the Lynx want it. As they look to build themselves towards another shot at the title, this team looks forward to the challenges in what should be another thrilling season. Our team slogan this year is "Bring the Heat," Miller said. We feel like every year we get everyone's best shot, but a runner-up finish has ratcheted those feelings up. We welcome those challenges and want our opponents to bring the heat so we can refine and improve. Growth happens through challenges and difficulties. We want everyone to play their best against us, and we are going to bring our best every time. Then we'll see who can withstand the heat. The Lynx will host St. Albert for their first game of the season on March 28th at 5:30 p.m. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 24th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Mel from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.